On to a whole new topic, ideology. Ideology. This kind of completes the sort of trilogy, class, state, and ideology, as the anchoring terms for the class and for really the, I would say, the sort of three big anchors for the Marxist tradition. If you read a work in which the terms class, state, and ideology appear a lot, it's almost certainly informed by the Marxist tradition of social theory. The term ideology has both an ordinary language meaning and then a more technical set of meanings. There were more than needed copies, so there should be a little stash of the outline sitting somewhere. But, okay. It's used in a lot of different ways. I'm going to be developing the distinctive way that this concept has been used, particularly in more recent Marxian discussions. But I don't think that one should regard this particular use of the word ideology as somehow privileged relative to the other ways it's used in discussions. And you should, with all concepts, you always have to worry about the relationship between the way the word is used and the nature of the concept the word is meant to capture. And ideology is certainly a case where that's true. So here, when you just think of what are the common ways it's used, one way that ideology is used is as a way of describing false ideas. That's ideological, meaning it's ideas that are driven by some agenda rather than ideas that have been subjected to proper scrutiny. One way of defining ideology in some discussions, ideology is the other of science. So the contrast is ideology versus science. That's one way that the term is used. Sometimes ideology is used to define any systematized configuration of beliefs, where those beliefs have a systematic and coherent organization. So there the contrast is ideological versus chaotic ways of thinking. So some people's beliefs are just helter-skelter mishmashes of different things. Their ideas don't have any coherence. There's no organizing core that renders the ideas part of some configuration. They just believe this and that in a kind of mishmash way. That's ideological beliefs are coherently organized versus chaotic beliefs. And that's different from the ideology versus science view. Ideology versus science is a way of describing how the beliefs are produced rather than what the actual beliefs might happen to be. There's a scientific way of generating beliefs and there's an ideological way of generating beliefs. This is the second sense of the word ideology, is there's a coherent configuration of beliefs versus a chaotic configuration. There's some famous studies of American voters, for example. Converse is the political scientist who did these in the 1950s, a famous book called The American Voter, in which one of the big contrasts is between voters who actually have an ideology. So they ask of at any election, how do the positions of this candidate fit with my set of coherent positions? And other people who don't vote ideologically. So when it's said, for example, that some people vote on the basis of the personality of the candidate, they like the person better, that's non-ideological voting. Meaning that it's not that they have no views on matters, but the views don't crystallize into some coherent position. A third way of defining ideology, and this is the way that emerged out of at least some of the Marxian discussions in the 1960s and 70s, is that ideology is a multidimensional concept that maps socially relevant aspects of subjectivity. So everybody everybody's subjectivity is ideological. It's not that you can contrast a person with an ideological subjectivity and a non-ideological. The question is, what ideology is embodied in your subjectivity? I'm going to be working mostly in this third way of talking about it. We will have some discussion that draws a contrast between ideology and science. And particularly when we talk about the question of the contradictions in ideology and the transformations of ideology, the issue of how systematized versus chaotic is the configuration will figure. The kind of fracturing and disorganization of the set of beliefs that a person holds is one of the contexts for the transformation of ideology, where a tight configuration breaks down. That's an opening for reconfiguration. So first, let me give you one final terminological convention I'll use, and then we'll get to the beginning of the definition. Sometimes ideology is discussed as an ideology. It's used as a noun, an ideology. When the term is used that way, we're discussing this ideology versus that ideology. So we're discussing an ideology as a noun. When I use it that way, it's reference to a system of beliefs. But ideology is also used as an adjective, ideological practices in particular. Right, so remember we had political practices and we discussed what that was and economic practices. Ideology is also a way of talking about a kind of practice that we engage in. This is a reference to the process of producing beliefs that are incorporated within subjectivity. And ideological practice is a way of talking about how beliefs are produced and incorporated into subjectivity. An ideology refers to what it is that is so incorporated. So when I use it as a noun, it's the set of beliefs. When I use it as an adjective, modifying practices, it's describing a process through which beliefs get incorporated into people's subjectivity. Okay. Now, let me recapitulate a little bit of what I've already talked about when we discuss political practices. That is, let me talk about ideology as a practice in contrast to other practices. So some of this is just repetitive. Economic practice is a process of producing use values through the transformation of nature as a raw material. Remember, practice is a way of talking about how you produce different things. There's always an outcome, and the idea of producing something means there's a process of transformation. That's what it means to produce something. You transform some input into an output. The paradigm case is the labor process and production process in an economic system where nature is transformed through those productive processes or economic practices into a product. Okay, that's economic practice. Political practice is the process of producing social relations through the transformation of social interactions as a raw material. So we have social interactions, but they aren't chaotic. They're not just sort of random. They're transformed. These individual encounters that we call a social interaction are transformed into stable relations, and that process of transforming and producing social relations themselves is the most general notion of political practice. Ideological practice is the process of producing conscious dimensions of subjectivity through the transformation of individual lived experience into beliefs. So the raw material are all the things that happen to you, all the experience you have, all the sense data you You acquire all the perceptions and experiences and encounters you have. These are your lived experiences. What an ideological practice does is transforms that raw material into actual beliefs which you hold. Ideological practice is the process by which all of your experiences get turned into actual beliefs that you hold as stable ideas in your subjectivity. One way of thinking about this, then, is that ideological practices have as their output cognitive products. They're part of your cognition. They're the content of the ideas that you hold. I like to distinguish ideological practice from cultural practice. Some people don't make this distinction. Some people use the term cultural practice as an overarching one. Some people use ideological practice as the most general one. I like to draw a distinction between what can be called ideological practices and cultural practices. Ideological practices produce the conscious dimensions of subjectivity, that is, beliefs. Cultural practices produce the non-conscious dimensions of subjectivity. Our dispositions, our personality, our kind of unconscious or non-conscious aspects of our subjectivity. This is very close to Bourdieu's notion of habitus. Culture produces habitus, ideology produces beliefs. There are nice contexts in which you can draw a distinction between these, and I'll bring this up again later in the lecture, but just to make it clear, you can have the belief as a man that aggressive competitive behavior is a good thing. That's a belief. It's a desirable way to be. You believe that it has positive effects in the world, and it's a way of affirming oneself as a man to be aggressive and competitive. But you can hold that belief that it's a good thing without actually having the disposition. You can be pretty shy and pretty reticent and still believe that aggression and competitiveness is a good thing. It's just that you're bad at it, right? So you may not have the dispositions to be competitive, even if you have the belief that competitiveness is good. A masculinist culture instills in men the actual dispositions to be competitive and aggressive, not just the beliefs that it's a good thing. One can say the same thing about the dispositions of women, that women can believe that it's not a good thing for women to be aggressive, but they may be personally quite aggressive, right? They may have all the competitive urges and vice versa. Now, this opens up a space where there can be a disjuncture between one's beliefs and one's dispositions. What's called consciousness raising, and what was central to the women's movement in the 60s and 70s, the idea of consciousness raising, was precisely a view that you could intervene into people's subjectivity collectively by acting on beliefs as a way of raising your self-understanding. And by doing so, you could change people's practices, their behavior, the way they lived in the world, even in the absence of having changed their dispositions. So people engaged in assertiveness training, that is, they came to believe that assertiveness was good, and then they had to train themselves to be assertive. That is changing the culture. The assertiveness training was meant to change the underlying dispositions, to give you the skills and the comfort level and the habitus, the automatic, context-specific disposition to act that way. That would correspond to the new beliefs that people had acquired through consciousness raising. Well, I like to think of that as the contrast between ideology and culture. Generally, I think ideology is easier to change than culture. It's easier to change people's beliefs about something than to change their underlying dispositions. But that changing ideology can be a leading edge for changing culture. That is, for people to change the way they actually experience the world and feel things. You can think of this as also cognition versus emotion. That's partially what's bound up in this. And certainly, that has been the central way in which the left has thought about changing subjectivity. Some people argue that that's a weakness of the left, that the left has too much of a cognitive approach to these matters, that they believe it's a kind of enlightenment problem of the Enlightenment era, you know, that we believe in rationality and that you can change people's minds by changing their beliefs. And then the underlying dispositions and personality and emotional aspects follow in its wake, as opposed to you should work directly on their emotions. Try to get people's underlying emotions to change, which would then support a different set of beliefs. Well, we'll talk about that in due course, whether that's a good or bad thing. My own view is that working on beliefs, I think in a fundamental way, shows more respect for the person than trying to transform their culture. You know, that consciousness raising is, in a sense, a more autonomy respecting way of thinking about how you try to change people's subjectivity than is a direct attempt to manipulate and transform their culture. But this is something we can talk about. So we have economic practice, political practice, ideological practice, producing the cognitive, conscious aspects of subjectivity, cultural practice, all the practices that produce the unconscious, emotional, dispositional aspects of subjectivity. We can also talk about theoretical practices or scientific practices. This is the process of producing knowledge of social relations through the transformation of ideology as a raw material. Now, this would get us into a whole big philosophy of science discussion, but one way of thinking about what science does is it takes all of the beliefs that people have that are the result of their encounter with the world and the ideologies which they've incorporated and subjects those beliefs themselves to a particular set of practices, a particular set of procedures. And the procedures that you subject those beliefs to have as their product scientific knowledge rather than simply beliefs. Now here's the tricky bit, okay? You produce scientific knowledge through a theoretical practice. But when you come to believe that scientific knowledge, when you actually incorporate it into your own subjectivity, that's an ideological practice. Right? So a teacher who's teaching science and teaching the results of all the scientific research that's been done and wants to convince students to believe this stuff, that practice is an ideological practice. That's not the scientific practice. That's why this is... Now, this gets a little bit murky and confusing. But that's how I like to think of the way to parse these different terms. Yeah.
So is there any way for an individual to have a scientific knowledge? Or because they believe something, it's always ideological?
No, of course you could. If you assess your own beliefs through the use of through scientific scrutiny, mm-hmm. then you confirm to yourself that the beliefs you hold are, and the content of those beliefs are indeed scientific, as best as you can judge.
Yeah, actually, my better question would be, can someone transfer their scientific knowledge onto someone else, or does that person have to go through the same processes of going through their, like, and testing their beliefs?
So what I can do is I can say, look, I have this set of beliefs, which I believe to be scientific because I've studied science and you have confidence that I'm telling you the truth and so on. And I think therefore you should accept these beliefs as well. But you shouldn't accept them simply because I tell you. You should accept them because these beliefs have gone through that process of production. And if for some of those beliefs you can check it out yourself. You know, some of them you'll just accept because you believe enough, you've subjected enough of your beliefs to this kind of reflexive scientific scrutiny. So science is a way of assessing the truth content of the beliefs you hold. But if you hold them, if they're instantiated in your subjectivity, that's the ideology you hold. I don't want us to spend too much time just worrying about this because there's too much other things that we have to contend with here. Let me just add one other thing. It's possible that one might want to specify a distinctive additional aspect of practice. One might want to talk about religious or spiritual practices. In the same spirit that one talks about scientific practices, that is, it's a way of producing a particular, a spiritual practice is a way of producing a particular kind of understanding or belief or subjectivity. When it's actually held, when it's incorporated into your belief system, that's an ideological practice. But if the content of what you are believing has to do with ultimate meanings and purposes of life, you have to figure out what is the dimension of beliefs that renders it religious or spiritual. I like to think of it as meaning of life kind of issues. Then the content is, the particular content of those beliefs is religious, even though their embodiment in your belief system is ideological. Marxism, in that sense, could constitute a religious practice. In that, Marxism generates a set of purposes and senses of meaning in the world, but all sorts of other traditions do as well. This way of thinking of, and I'm not sure this is right, this is just flippant on my part perhaps, this way of talking about a religious practice distances it from any particular theological content. It has to do with practices that produce meaning, as opposed to practices that produce otherworldly meaning. But we can put that aside. I personally think there's some use to thinking about it this way, but I'm just tossing this out for you to chew over. So summing all this up, ideological practice is a social process. It's a social process. Ideological practice is a social process through which conscious subjectivity is formed. Your conscious subjectivity, the aspects of your subjectivity that you have access to through reflection, your conscious subjectivity is formed. Through the real activities of people engaged in social relations, in which what happens to them, experiences are transformed into cognitive products. So you go into a store and you know, because of all the beliefs you've learned over your lifetime, that the things on the shelves of the store are potentially things that you could take away. You have a whole set of beliefs as to what it means to have things on a shelf and what property rights are. You have all these beliefs about what you're observing. And you've learned those beliefs, you've incorporated those beliefs into your understanding of how the world works from early childhood. When you were little and went into a store, you might just take something off of the shelf and put it in your pocket, and you would be told, no, that's not the same as something on the shelf in your house. This is a store. When you go into a store, you can't just take things, you have to take them and pay for them. And you gradually learn what these categories are. You learn what money is, you learn what objects on stores are, and you learn how to engage in that transaction. Well, that's a complicated set of actual beliefs that have been incorporated into your subjectivity, which enables you to function really effectively in stores. And people who didn't know that wouldn't function effectively. Those are cognitive products. You know, you could ask somebody the question. They may not be consciously thinking about it all the time, but it is accessible to them. You could ask anybody who has learned all this stuff, okay, what is this? It's a store. What are these things on the shelves? Well, they're things that I might want. How do you get to take them? Of course, everybody knows that. But you take somebody, imagine, just take somebody who's grown up in the Amazon and has never been in a store and put them in a store, of course they wouldn't know what these categories were. They wouldn't have a classification system of things in the world. Well, that's what ideology gives you, is, among other things. We'll get into the other things it gives you. Gives you answers to questions. What exists? Well, these are the classifications of the things in the world and how they're connected. Those are cognitive products. That's what an ideology gives you. Let me give you an example of this idea that ideology produces cognitive products. Michael Burovoy has a very, I think, rich analysis of the way in which the beliefs workers have in the labor force, in the labor process, of their cognitive subjectivity, how it develops. Burovoy argues that workers participate in their own exploitation actively. That is, they consent to their own exploitation. Not by virtue of the subjective orientation they bring into the shop floor from the outside. That is, not primarily because of socialization from the outside, but because of the forms of subjectivity that get produced inside of the process of production itself, through competition and conflict on the shop floor itself. The heart of his analysis is about the social process through which given forms of subjectivity are produced and reproduced in the daily practices of workers in the labor process. His approach to studying the ideologies of consent, people's agreement to the conditions of work, is not primarily what they've been taught before they enter work. It's what they learn once they're inside of the labor process itself. Now, that is a process of the production, that is an analysis of how ideology is generated, about the nature of the ideological practices inside of the labor process. Okay, that's our first set of considerations. Ideological practice in contrast to economic and political practice, especially. Secondary contrast to cultural practice. What does it produce? It produces beliefs. What's the raw material? Well, the raw material for the beliefs you hold are things that happen to you, things that you experience. It's also the case that a raw material for the beliefs you hold are prior beliefs you held. So ideological practice also operates on the transformation of beliefs. But the way to think of it is, again, just the, what is the production process through which the beliefs you hold are held by you? Ideological practices are about the instantiation of those beliefs. It's not about their invention, in art or in culture, in practices that people do. It's about how you come to hold those beliefs. Once again, let me make another distinction. This is 2.2, the distinction between a type and a dimension of practice. So one ideology, as I've defined it, is a dimension of all practices rather than simply a type of practice. When the ideological aspect of a practice is central, is its central intentional goal, we can speak of doing ideology. You can speak of an ideological practice. Education is an ideological practice in this sense. The central task of education is the transformation of the subjectivity, particularly the cognitive subjectivity, of actors. Now, there are also cultural practices in education. Part of the product of education is discipline, is a set of underlying dispositions. A lot of educational research focuses on the cultural practices, not the ideological practices of education. Particularly in the 1970s, there were a series of famous studies, learning to labor or education in capitalist America, are two sort of classic studies about how the educational system instills dispositions rather than just beliefs. Bourdieu's approach to education is primarily about the installation, the instillment of dispositions rather than of beliefs. So you, when the purpose of the practice is the installation, the instantiation, the conveyance of beliefs into people, when that's the purpose of it, we can say it is an ideological practice. When it's simply a byproduct of what you do, then it's an ideological aspect of a practice. The ideological aspects of practices are pervasive. All sorts of things people do have the side effect of reinforcing or undermining the beliefs people hold. But only some of the practices people engage in have as their purpose the undermining or reinforcing of beliefs people hold. One final point here, ideology is a contradictory practice. The forms of subjectivity that are produced by ideological practices are never wholly integrative of capitalism. They're never fully functional. It's just too complicated. It's just too implausible that all the beliefs people hold are tightly integrated in such a way as to be exactly the sorts of beliefs that are optimal for the functioning of anything. Our experiences are too heterogeneous, and the way those experiences get turned into beliefs are too heterogeneous for ideology to ever be as totalizing as some accounts of ideology suggest. And indeed, the contradictory aspects of ideology, I think, are absolutely central if we are to imagine the possibility of transformation, of social transformation. So I've already mentioned this next point, the ideology and culture contrast. Let me just briefly reiterate it in more synoptic form. Ideology produces conscious subjectivity. Culture produces the unconscious aspects of subjectivity. Patriarchal ideology are the beliefs in the naturalness of the sexual division of labor, in the desirability of men being aggressive and competitive and women being nurturing and engaged in emotional work. That's the ideology, the belief that it is natural for women to be nurturing and natural for men to be competitive. Those are beliefs that people hold, the belief in the naturalness of these dispositions. And those beliefs can be thought of as masculinist ideology or patriarchal ideology, to use an older term. Patriarchal culture, on the other hand, is the socialization of masculine and feminine attributes differentially in boys and girls, so that men are dispositionally more aggressive and women are dispositionally more nurturant. That's what a gendered culture accomplishes. It accomplishes a polarization of dispositions by gender, underlying and corresponding to the polarization of beliefs. So if you have a really tightly organized gendered culture and ideology working together, the beliefs people hold correspond to their underlying dispositions, which tends to reinforce the view that these traits are natural. So if you look around the world in which you live, and you see that nearly all women are way more nurturant than nearly all men, and nearly all men are way more aggressive than nearly all women, that observational contrast, which is an accomplishment of a patriarchal culture, reinforces the patriarchal ideology that such differences between biological sexes are natural. The same thing can be said about bourgeois ideology and bourgeois culture. Beliefs in the efficiency of private enterprise and the justice of the distribution produced by markets, those beliefs are bourgeois ideology. The belief that it's a good thing and that these institutions are efficient, that they provide for the well-being of people that as efficiently as possible, and that they're morally justified. These are beliefs. That's bourgeois ideology. The unconscious dispositions, habits, personality structures to participate effectively in capitalist markets, to be comfortable engaging in these practices, those underlying dispositions would be part of bourgeois culture. Consumerism as a disposition for how you experience enjoyment and success, consumerism as an aspect of bourgeois culture, the belief that this, the conscious belief that this creates the best ways of life is part of bourgeois ideology. So all of these things have both cultural and ideological aspects. The key dynamic question, which is fundamental for the role that ideology plays in the transformation of social relations, is the potential contradiction between ideological and cultural practices. If there was no contradiction between them, if it was seamless, that ideological, the beliefs you hold and the underlying dispositions always meshed and tightly reinforced each other, then the prospects for transforming the world in part by transforming the beliefs of people would be way harder. It'd be much tougher to transform beliefs if they were always tightly connected to underlying dispositions. Many men believe in non-aggressive nurturance, even though they have been socialized to be aggressive and non-nurturant. So there are many men whose socialization is masculinist, but whose beliefs are anti-masculinist. Changing ideas can lead to changes in behavior, which result in changes in dispositions. This is the key idea, I think, or a key idea in Terborn's account of the possibility of transformations of subjectivity. That you can act on beliefs and unhinge them from underlying dispositions, that the underlying dispositions don't determine the beliefs you hold, that the beliefs have a certain autonomy from underlying dispositions, and that that's a point of entry then in the transformation of the configurations themselves. Again, that's essentially what's captured by the expression consciousness raising, as that was developed in the women's movement, which had a very clear view of these matters. And I think unlike the class equivalence of consciousness raising, one of the distinctive things in the women's movement was the realization that it required real cultural work to transform the underlying dispositions that corresponded to the new forms of consciousness. Whereas on the left, in the class context, there was more a sense that as long as you changed people's beliefs about the kind of world they lived in and the kind of world they wanted, that would be sufficient, that the you didn't have to directly work on trying to change the underlying dispositions. Yeah?
So you say that changing ideas can result in changing behaviors, and then these things can affect the dispositions. Can you go back one step further and say that it's affecting people's lived experiences that changes their ideas then? So like, the fact that women got together and talked about these things is a way in which it changed their lived experiences, and then that changes their ideas.
So the first task is you have to get the women to get together, which means there's already something in their lived experience which is in tension with their beliefs. So they've been socialized into a certain set of beliefs about how the world is, about what it means to be a woman, about what kinds of relations are natural, then things are happening in their lives which are in tension with their beliefs, but which they don't have interpretive categories. Right? So there's a kind of, if you will, there's an accumulation of under-interpreted, incorporated experience that's a reservoir that then can be tapped. And the signal that was the case was how rapidly, once the women's movement got going and women saw the actions of women, people doing things that violated their expectations, how many women were then drawn to saying, well, what's going on here? And men, you know, I'm focusing on women because that was the heart of the ideological aspect of the movement, but of course many men trailed after them, also realizing that there was an accumulation of their own life experiences that were not corresponding to their beliefs about their own lives. The belief aspect, you know, sometimes it's easy to change, sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's extremely rapid. When people realize their belief system has been thinned out by an accumulation of experiences that didn't mesh with their beliefs, and once they kind of see that, get the message, it's like that. People use the expression epiphany. You know, they suddenly say, "Oh my God, you're right. You know, this isn't a natural category. I've been under these constraints that have been making me miserable. That's why I'm miserable. You know, I'm miserable because I'm not able to engage in creative work outside the home," or whatever is the particular point of entry. So there's, I think, and this will get to the Terreborn. There's a disjuncture that's occurring between your lived experience and your beliefs, in which there's an accumulating tension, which can be reflected in all sorts of uneasiness that people have. And then there's a social movement which presents new ideas, new ways of interpreting the way your life has gone, which can then very rapidly trigger a sense of, yes, I need to know more about this, which draws you into then a consciousness-raising group which says, okay, now we can give you a coherent understanding, not just a fragmentary understanding. And then people still, that's not sufficient. They're still uncomfortable standing up to in a meeting and speaking when there's a bunch of aggressive men around, and they have to bolster their courage. They need to bring their sisters along. You know, so solidarity helps a lot. If you bring a group of people who you know are supporting you and are on your side, then you can strengthen your dispositions to act more autonomously in those situations.
So you say that there are tensions that exist within our lived experiences. Would you say then that you could go back even further and say that that's based on the material conditions of our society? So like capitalism, like class society, and then as well as like the fact that our society is extremely sexist?
So it's not the sexism per se that generates the discordance, because the sexism could so totally correspond to your beliefs that you don't interpret it as sexist. Right? So something has to disrupt the relationship between your lived experiences and your interpretations of those experiences. Now, one possibility is that the interpretations were never all that good at making sense of your experience. So I would say there are plenty of instances where it was never the case that the ideology was that successful in creating a set of beliefs that incorporated those lived experiences in the way that dominant social forces wanted. Slavery is a good example. Slaves never fully adopted the belief system of slave masters. You know, it just is not the case. I mean, they didn't believe in slavery. That's why slavery was enforced through massive repression continuously, rather than through the subjectivities of the slaves. Now, there were aspects of both dispositions and beliefs that accommodated to slavery that meant that the repression was corresponded to some aspects of subjectivity, but in a very weak way. It didn't. So that never had this kind of tight functional correspondence between underlying dispositions, beliefs, and the requirements of the roles in which people live. So one reason why these belief systems can be disrupted is that there may never have been as tight a connection between beliefs and lived experience as one might have thought. But the other is that the lived experiences change, and that's Terreborn's argument is that that's typically because socioeconomic conditions change in ways that create a disjuncture between the systems that generate your beliefs about the world in which you live and the experiences being generated by that world. But to get to that, we should go through Terborne's account. I think this is a fantastic book. Parts of it are, parts of it are more underdeveloped than others. Given that it's such a short and punchy book, it's pretty, I think, a pretty remarkable piece. Personally, I think that it's a better grounding for a theory of subjectivity, a sociological account of subjectivity and its complexity than Bourdieu is. You know, and this is pre-Bourdieu. This is, you know, he talks about the equivalent of habitus, Terborne does, before Bourdieu did. And I think it's a richer vocabulary than Bourdieu has. It has many more dimensions. It has many more mechanisms. And it commits itself to some content. It's not as sort of content-free as some of Bourdieu is. So my personal view is that this is an underappreciated classic. For those of you who know Bourdieu well, it's not a bad idea for one of the short papers to do a comparison of Terborne and Bourdieu. You know, I'm waiting for somebody. As far as I know, nobody's published a really dynamite theoretical paper, a Terbornean confrontation with Bourdieu on habitus and subjectivity. So somebody sometime is going to write a really good paper of that sort. In any case, let me give you Terborne's, the basic ingredients of his argument. First of all, Terborne is working off of Althusser's framework. So Louis Althusser was this French philosopher, most productive in the 60s and early 70s. He then had a psychotic break. It's a sad story. I don't think his mental illness had anything to do with the character of his theoretical arguments. But he was extremely influential. He had a very intellectually powerful group of students in the typical French way of, like Bourdieu as well, the head of a circle who were devoted almost as disciples. So he was extremely productive, deeply engaged and embedded in Communist Party fights and disputes, so there's all sorts of ulterior purposes going on. Althusser had relentless attacks at what he called humanist Marxism, which is what led him to be identified as a kind of hyper-structuralist. And some of his statements are just kind of outrageously extreme, hyperbolic in his what was called anti-humanism. So he would write things. He would say things like, "History is a process without a subject," that human beings are not the authors of their own lives. Well, there's a sense in which we can all understand what he's talking about, and a sense in which it's completely opaque what he's talking about. So agency and choice and self-directed action have no role in his account. But nevertheless, they sneak in through the back door, because it's kind of hard to imagine why would you bother writing anything that would attempt to influence the way in which class struggles occur if you didn't feel that people were in some sense or other the authors of their lives, there was no agency whatsoever. So like most hyper-structuralist positions, it begins to lose coherence when you really push it, and in particular once you interrogate why the person's bothering to write it. But he literally said he wasn't the author of his own works. Didn't use the word embodiment. It was, crystallization of forces. Anyway, that was his teacher. Well, Terborne took some of the ideas and some of the language. The language in some particulars sounds pretty weird now because it's no longer in play. But then really decided that in order for this to make any sense, you had to think about the mechanisms that were actually at work in the world. And that was a very big additional step. And that's the step in which I think it's not really correct to see Terborne as an Althusserian, because that additional step, what are the actual mechanisms that generate these effects, really shifts the analysis in a different way. The word that he uses that has the most Althusserian pedigree is interpolation. Ideology interpolates people in social relations. Interpolation, I don't even think it's an English word. I'm not sure it was a French word. It probably was. Probably was a French word before Althusser used it. Interpolation is typically translated in English as hails, you know, like you're, I hail you, I tell you who you are. Hey, you, this is who you are and how you fit in the world. What does that mean? I don't think you need the word in any way to understand Terborn, but he does use it from time to time. What I'm going to do is explain the stuff of his argument, the real substance of how he thinks about how ideology works and what the mechanisms are. That's the key point that enables ideology to work the way it does. And then I'll explain how the term interpolation fits into this. But I won't do it by beginning by defining interpolation. Okay. Before I go any further, let me give you a direct quote from Terborn, his definition of ideology. And it has within it, I think, a really beautiful phrase. It's not that I think, Terborn is not a poetic writer. You know, it's not beautiful, but there are occasional phrases that are, I think, fantastic. And this is one, is a really great phrase. So here's his definition. The operation of ideology in human life involves fundamentally constituting and patterning how human beings live their lives, and now comes the beautiful part, as conscious, reflecting, initiators of acts in a universe of meaning. I really like that expression. Conscious, reflecting, initiators of acts in a universe of meaning. In this sense, ideology constitutes human beings as subjects. That's what ideology does. It turns us from simply beings into social subjects. Elsewhere, he says to study the ideological aspect of a practice is to focus on the way it operates in the formation and transformation of human subjectivity. It makes us conscious, reflecting, initiators of acts. That's a very strong agency idea. We are initiators of acts. We initiate as conscious initiators, but also, it's a nice little extra word, a conscious reflecting initiators of acts. That is where we reflect upon our own conscious initiation of acts in a universe of meaning. That's what ideology accomplishes. This is similar to Althusser's definition, but more exhaustive and implying that what ideology does is enables us to be agents, not just robots in the field of social relations and interactions. In order to understand then how Terborn plays this out, we need to go through the particular vocabulary that he introduces, which I think is a pretty useful one. This is point two under Terborn. It's the set of conceptual distinctions on the terrain of ideology. These conceptual innovations can be clustered under two headings. There are a set of distinctions he makes on the dimensions of ideology and its effects, and then a discussion of the relationship between what he calls the discursive and non-discursive practices of ideology. Now that sounds super jargony, but it's actually a pretty interesting distinction, and a distinction that often doesn't get made. The distinction between the discursive practices, that is, the practices of ideology that involve words, and the non-discursive practices of ideology. That is, the practices of ideology that doesn't involve speech, doesn't involve words. And understanding that connection is a pretty interesting aspect of how Terborn develops this terrain of ideology and its potential contradictions. I think we should take our break and then continue. Just to relieve you of any worry, if you are worried, about the balance between lecture and discussion in this block of the course. This first lecture has more talk on my part. The remaining ones on mystification on Thursday, hegemony next Tuesday, and the micro foundations of ideology next Thursday, for each of those, they're much more compact lectures. So some of the issues from today's lecture that we won't have time to discuss, we can fold into the subsequent ones. But let's take our break now and reconvene at 10 after.